We'll continue talking about decision trees. So we talked last class, gave a brief overview of what the essence of a decision tree was. We'll go into much more detail today. So decision trees attempt to classify a pattern through a sequence of questions. For example, attributes such as gender and height can be used to classify people as short or tall, but the best threshold for height is gender dependent. So a decision tree is a good way to deal with that kind of a situation because we can actually create a tree that allows us to have context-specific questions, or in this case, gender-dependent questions. So, for example, here we have a tree that splits into male and female, and then for each of these, for the male class, we can have a threshold for height, short and tall, and for female, we can have a threshold for height that's short and tall, rather than having one threshold for both genders. And that kind of descriptive power can be very powerful in pattern classification, as we'll see in a moment. So a decision tree consists of nodes and leaves, with each leaf containing a class. So we have nodes, we have these leaves, and the attributes, gender and height, are a set of features that describe the data. So to train a decision tree, we're going to need data that's labeled with these attributes, and we'll need to sort of figure out which attributes are good and which attributes aren't good. So the input data consists of values of the different attributes. Using these attribute values, the decision tree generates a class as the output for each input data. So let's see how this works in a little more detail. So the top of the tree the first node is called the root node. The last level of nodes are called the leaf nodes and contain the final classification. So when you hit the bottom of the tree, the output of the tree then is going to be the class associated with the input pattern. The intermediate nodes are descendant or hidden layers. So this can be thought of as another hidden state or hidden layer type modeling problem, much like a neural network and a hidden Markov model. Binary trees, like the one shown to the right, are the most popular type of tree. By binary, we mean that at each node, you have only two possible paths. MRE trees, M branches at each node, are also possible, though they're not as popular as the binary tree. Nodes can contain one or more questions. In a binary tree, by convention, if the answer to a question is yes, the left branch is selected, and if the answer is no, the right branch is selected. Note that the same question can appear in multiple places in the network. That way we can have these context-specific type thresholds and such. Decision trees have several benefits over neural network type approaches, including interpretability and data-driven learning. So what that means is, in terms of interpretability, once you're done training a decision tree, it's very easy to look at the tree and understand a lot about the organization of your data. Whereas with the neural network, we talk about the fact that the information is spread about the network, and it's not really easy to interpret a network once it's trained. So decision trees are very popular because you can actually learn a lot about your data from the process of training the tree. They're also a data-driven approach, and they're a very powerful data-driven approach in that decision trees will do a very good job of modeling the training data. Like most of these techniques, they suffer from the problem of overfitting, but at the same time, the organization of the tree is going to depend on the data that is presented. Key questions then are going to include how to grow the tree, how to stop growing the tree, and how to prune the tree to increase generalization. Those are the three basic problems that we're going to talk about today. Decision trees are very powerful and can give excellent performance on closed set testing, meaning if you evaluate on the same data that you trained, you will get a very low error rate, if not a 0% error rate. But the challenge is going to be generalization. And how does the tree work on unseen data? Now, why decision trees are so popular? Well, one of the big reasons is that we can actually build nonlinear decision surfaces. we can sort of approximate them actually as a sequence of straight lines. But so here we have an example of data, which is two classes which can only be separated by some kind of curved surface. And you can think of what a decision tree is going to do in a case like this. If we use questions regarding the range of values for X, you could easily construct a decision tree where we have these kinds of questions for X and Y. And the impact of this tree, if you really think about this, what that means in terms of this space, it's essentially carving this space up into small rectangular regions and allowing you to then have a class associated with each one of these rectangular regions. And that's simply done by successively dividing both the X and the Y axis into intervals. Now, the power of that is that you can essentially approximate surfaces like this with a series of these cells. And if you make the cells small enough, you can get a good level of approximation. On the other hand, the danger in making the cells small is that you could encounter overtraining. So they're an attractive alternative to other classifiers we've studied because they're data-driven and can give arbitrarily high levels of precision on the training data, but as we've said, generalization becomes a challenge. The training time for decision trees can also be very fast, and that's another reason people like this approach, because it's fairly easy to grow and train the tree. And then the runtime performance is very fast as well, because you just have essentially a series of questions that you have to ask. And since it's a binary tree, the complexity is roughly going to be log two of the depth of the tree. So it's sort of like a binary sort type approach. It can be very fast. And because of all those reasons, these became very, very popular in my research field. In the late 90s, decision trees really came into the forefront, and as we'll talk at the end of the lecture today, we've actually applied them in several ways to the speech recognition problem, and we use them as standard piece of a state-of-the-art speech recognition system today. And when they were introduced in the late 90s, we applied them to a lot of different aspects of the speech recognition problem because of their power to model data. So the first major category for decision trees are what are known as classification and regression trees, and this is often abbreviated as CART. Let's consider a set of D label training data and a set of properties or questions T. So the data is going to be labeled in terms of all of the questions. And the questions are going to be things like, is the sex male or female? They're really specific to your problem. But you're going to need the training data labeled in terms of these questions. So generally what happens is you take your training data and your training data has a lot of information associated with it. And then as you're trying to build these trees, you work with a subset of the questions on the training data. So one of the drawbacks of the decision tree approach is you need data which is extensively labeled, and we don't often have that for many problems. There are actually two types of trees, you could say. There's one which deals with the nominal data like demographic information about your user. And then there are trees which actually deal with continuous value data. You can actually run decision trees directly on feature values and let the decision tree learn the right threshold, you know, if X is less than 3 but greater than 2 and that kind of thing. We'll touch on the nominal trees today. We won't talk too much about the continuous value trees. But the techniques are similar. The only trick is the trees are only as good as the questions. You have to ask the right questions to allow the tree to get the right answer. So the construction, the challenge here is the creation of the question. How do we organize the tree to produce the lowest classification error? Any decision tree will successively split the data into smaller and smaller subsets. It would be ideal if all the samples associated with the left node were from the small class. Such a subset or node is considered pure in this case. So what we're going to look at, we'll refine this in a moment in terms of entropy, but what we're going to look at is a situation where you're sitting at a node and you have a bunch of data associated with that node. And now you want to essentially make a split of that data into two finer nodes. The question is sort of what is the best way to split the data? Obviously, if you split the data so that all the data was in one of the one of the lower nodes, and none of the data was in the other node, that wouldn't be a good split. So we're going to show in a moment that what you really want to do is split the data so that they end up about equally split between the two nodes. That's sort of a good split of the data. And if you do that continually throughout the tree, you'll end up with a tree which essentially has at the leaves one pattern in every leaf node, which is actually too much, but we'll talk about that. In a moment, but it's generally good that with each split, you're essentially having the data. So a generic tree growing methodology known as CART successively splits the nodes until they are pure. So we can talk about this in a set of six questions. Should the questions be binary and or numeric and or multivalued? And there's essentially algorithms that deal with both of those. Today, we'll look mostly at binary questions and non-numeric questions, but you can as well ask questions like what is the optimal value of a continuous value parameter to split the node. And some of the packages that exist for decision trees that we'll talk about towards the end of class actually have that kind of capability built into them. You can also have multi-valued questions. And in fact, with some trees, you can actually have combinations of questions at a node. A node need not be only one question. It can actually be a logical combination of questions. That just increases the complexity of training the node, and we won't really talk about that today. Which properties should be tested at each node? So this is a very important question, is how do you arrange the questions so that you get the sort of most bang for your buck with the tree? Part of the training process is actually figuring out what's the best question to ask at each node. And we'll talk about how to do that in a moment. When should a node be declared a leaf node? How do you decide that you're done, essentially? Now, you can always decide to quit when each leaf node has one and only one pattern in it. But then your tree is essentially, for most applications, far too specific to the training data. If a tree becomes too large, how can it be pruned? So one strategy is to actually grow the tree out until you have one pattern in each of the leaf nodes and then prune it back to a smaller, more manageable tree. If the leaf node is impure, what category should be assigned to it? That's a little more difficult because in the process of assigning a category, you're going to essentially have a certain error rate associated with the tree. And when we have to prune trees back, that's something we have to deal with. And then how should missing data be handled? Decision trees were introduced also as a technique to deal with missing data. We won't talk about that too much today. So this is an overview of the mechanics of the tree, of the decision tree process. So you load the data and the parameters, and then you essentially have either one of two modes to operate in. Either you can be in training mode or you can be in evaluation mode. So in training mode, what you do is you essentially take your pot of data and you find the best initial split. That'll be the root node if this is the first time through. You split the data according to this best split. So now you've got the data, you've got a root node, and you've got data split in one of two directions. And then you simply go back and you ask, is your stopping criterion satisfied, which we'll talk about what that might be in a moment. And if it isn't, Then you just repeat this again. You've now got these two nodes, and you decide which of those two nodes is the best one to split. You make that split, and then you go back and repeat. So you grow the tree essentially by splitting one node at a time. And that turns out to be a reasonable technique for giving you a very good tree. And then if your stopping criterion satisfied, then you essentially establish the nodes at the bottom of the tree as being leaf nodes, and you output the tree. Now, if you follow this process, you will not necessarily end up with what's called a balanced tree, meaning that every node is split and that every pathway down the tree has the same length. You could actually, in this case, have a tree where one side of the tree is very long and one side of the tree is very short. But in general, if you have good splitting criteria, every time you split a node, you're going to want to go back to a node at the same level until you've exhausted all the nodes at that level, and we'll explain why in a moment. On the evaluation or recognition side, it's essentially, people often like to call this pouring the data through the tree, but you essentially just load the tree, and then you just start processing your inputs. And your inputs are essentially, as you start at the top of the tree, and you just start asking the questions and following your path down the tree. And then at some point, you'll hit a leaf node. And when you hit a leaf node, then you can output a symbol. So let's talk a little bit about splitting. We prefer trees that are simple and compact. Why? So you have a technology here, much like neural networks and support vector machines, that will essentially drive the error rate to zero on your training data. But the cost of that is that you can have a very, very large and complex tree. So why do we prefer simple and compact? Because Occam's razor tells us that all things being equal, the simplest solution should be the most general. So we would like a way of splitting nodes so that we don't overgenerate on this tree. So here we have a little graphic of, we're looking at we're looking at height, essentially, and trying to split based on height. And we could split height based on any number of thresholds, or we could choose a different question and split based on hair color. And the question then becomes sort of which is the best split to make. So we seek a lot of the terminology from decision trees comes from the statistics literature. So sometimes they call these questions T property queries. But we seek a question that splits the data at a node to increase the purity at that node. So let's let I of N be denoted the impurity of node N. To split data at a node, we need to find the question that results in the greatest entropy reduction, because that's essentially equivalent to reducing the uncertainty. And what we want a decision tree to do, essentially, is to reduce the uncertainty. When you start the training process, it's completely random. You could say it's completely uncertain. You don't know which symbol, which class belongs with which symbol and all that kind of thing. But as you train the tree, you're essentially, with each iteration of the training, you're making the tree better and better able to describe the data, so you're removing uncertainty from the process. So what we can do is establish if you think about the process of splitting a node, you're going to end up with these two classes. This is a discrete distribution with two choices. So it's possible then to talk about the entropy of that distribution as simply being the sum of the probability times the log of the probability of each one of those choices. And then we would like the node that essentially results in the greatest increase or the greatest reduction in entropy. Because if the entropy is zero, then we're essentially done. Now, this function will actually peak when the two classes are equally likely. So if we use this kind of a splitting criterion, this is essentially often what's called twoing, which is the process of just trying to find the question that that splits the data into two equal-sized classes, or as close to that as possible. So what you'll essentially do is you'll test all of your questions on the data at that node, look at how each question splits the data, and choose the question that corresponds to a split where the two classes are equal, are equal size. Now, that's a very simple process, but it's very powerful, because if you think about that, at each node in the tree, you're essentially cutting down the size of the data at each subsequent node in half. So eventually, you're going to get down to one element in each class, if everything goes well. The only gotcha in this is that you're estimating, we again have a parameter estimation problem, that you're going to estimate this entropy, which requires an estimate of the probability distribution function. You're estimating that from the patterns actually existing at that node. Okay, and this is, so you've got a finite set of patterns, you're trying to estimate a distribution, and then you're computing essentially the entropy based on that estimate. And so naturally there's a chance that you could misestimate the true underlying distribution because you have a finite amount of data. So people do sometimes do things like smoothing of the distributions and modeling of the distributions and all the kinds of things we've learned about so that you can make a more intelligent estimate of the entropy reduction. Because as you get down further in the tree, the number of patterns that you have at each class is very small. And you're estimating these distributions from a very small number of patterns. However, this simple rule works very well, and you can actually get pretty impressive performance using this kind of a rule. So there are some alternate splitting criteria that you'll see. One is called variance impurity, and this is where we simply take the product of the two probabilities. And the reasoning behind this is because this is related to the variance of a distribution associated with the two classes. There's also something called Gini impurity, which is a sum of the pairwise probabilities. And this attempts to sort of predict the expected error rate at a node and split accordingly. So, and then there's a misclassification impurity, which is simply measures the minimum probability that a training pattern would be misclassified at node N. So these are just different ways of doing the splitting, different ways of deciding which is the best question to choose. But in practice, simple entropy splitting is very effective. And in fact, we've used simple entropy splitting on a lot of our speech applications. So, but I mentioned these because sometimes you'll see, particularly the Gini impurity, you'll see this in the literature. So just have some idea where these things come from. An obvious heuristic is to choose the query that maximizes the decrease in impurity. That's what we just discussed. And we can write an equation for that, where N sub L and N sub R are the left and right descendant nodes, and I of N sub L and I of N sub R are the respective impurities, and P sub L is the fraction of patterns at the node N that will be assigned to N sub L when query T sub I is chosen. So we can write the entropy reduction in terms of the anticipated grouping of the data according to the question. So that's just a mathematical way to write an expression for the change in entropy at the node were you to choose that question and were you to make that split. This approach is considered part of a class of algorithms known as greedy. So you'll often hear people in the computer science literature talk about decision trees as being a greedy algorithm, because they will essentially consume data and grow the tree accordingly. So they kind of, the term greedy kind of refers to the fact that these algorithms are consumptive of data and will model whatever variations they're seeing in the data with no limit. Now note that this decision is local and it does not guarantee an overall optimal tree. This process of growing the tree incrementally can be shown not to be optimal, and there are techniques that will give you a more optimal tree, but at significantly greater computational cost. A very interesting way that we get around this is simply to take the data, and you can split the data into subsets, and you can grow trees on those subsets, and then you can compare the trees that you get on those different subsets. So there are a number of strategies where we can shuffle the data to essentially generate different trees on the same data, and then get some idea from the way these trees are similar and the way these trees differ as to what the overall optimal tree might be. We can also consider a multi-way split at the node if you have more than a binary node, and people have explored this, but like I said, generally speaking, the binary trees have been used very effectively in pattern recognition in signal processing type applications. Now, so we've talked about growing the tree. Now the question is, when do we stop splitting? And there's a number of different criteria that people use for stopping the splitting. If we continue to grow the tree until each leaf node has the lowest impurity, then the data will be overfit, because you'll end up with a tree where the nodes are very, very sparse. They have very small amounts of data associated with each node. So there's two general strategies we use to control growing the tree. One is to simply stop the tree from growing when you've reached a certain level of performance or a certain level of distortion. The second is to grow the tree to its completion and then prune the tree back. And both techniques are actually used. A traditional approach to stopping splitting relies on what's called cross-validation. And I'll briefly describe that. So the validation process begins with taking your training data and sorting it, reserving perhaps 10% of your training data as what's called a held-out set. We then train the tree on 90% of the data and test that tree on the remaining 10% of the data. And this is, as I mentioned, often referred to as a held-out set. Then we do cross-validation, which is to repeat this for several independently chosen partitions of the data set. And then our stopping criterion becomes continued splitting until the error on the held-out data is minimized. So this is a very heuristic way of deciding when you should stop splitting, is to essentially monitor your performance on this held-out set. And if things go really well, if you remember the plots that we talk about in terms of machine learning, that performance on the training data will always go to zero, but performance on the test data will reach some minimum and then start getting worse as your tree becomes overfitted. So if this process is done properly, as you're growing the tree, the held out set, you'll actually see the error rate start to increase on the held out set. And that will be an indication then that you've now reached the point where the tree is starting to overfit. You could say this is computationally expensive because it requires multiple runs on the data, requires, and that kind of thing. So it would be nice to just have some kind of overall measure of the performance of the tree, and to stop that when you achieve or exceed that kind of a threshold. So Another approach is what's called reduction in impurity. It's to stop if the candidate split leads to a marginal reduction of the impurity. Now, the drawback, so this is also good. It's essentially saying when your nodes get to the point where the split is such that that split is not essentially doing you much good because all the data perhaps is getting split into one of the two subclasses. Your questions are no longer giving you a reduction in entropy because the data now at that node is fairly pure to begin with. So you can look at, you can decide to stop when the next split in the process appears to give you only a negligible reduction in entropy. Now, but the drawback to that, of course, is that you have to have a threshold on your entropy, and that threshold might very well be application specific. So then you have to worry about, am I using the right threshold for this process? But it's a second technique for stopping splitting. Another technique that you'll see a lot in the literature is what's called cost complexity pruning, splitting rather. And this is an approach where we use a global criteria function that combines the size and the impurity of the tree. This approach is related to minimum description length when the impurity is based on entropy. So there's a whole branch of information theory which tries to look at the complexity of things like trees in terms of their length. If the tree is very long, you can say, well, that's very complicated. That might not generalize well. If the tree is very short, it stands a better chance of generalizing. So we can construct a function which has a component which is related to the size of the tree, the size being the number of nodes in the tree, plus a component related to the purity or impurity of each one of these nodes. So this term sort of gives you the overall quality of the tree in terms of its classification performance. This term gives you something that's proportional to the size of the tree. And then we can essentially stop splitting when we achieve, when we exceed a threshold on this function. Now, again, theoretically this sounds nice, but in practice you have to worry about alpha, the parameter which trades the importance of these two quantities, and then you also have to worry about setting a threshold that could very well be application dependent. However, these kinds of approaches have been used across a broad range of pattern recognition applications. We can use something very similar to this for hidden Markov models, for example, to kind of control the model size. Cost complexity splitting or termination criterion is used. You will find it in some packages being used. There's other approaches based on statistical significance and hypothesis testing that attempt to assess the quality of the proposed split. So this is actually a very broad, very big field in the statistics literature, and there are a lot of different variants of decision trees that have been researched over the years. But generally speaking, what we like to do in practice is to do a combination of growing the tree until the additional new nodes are not giving you much of a reduction in entropy, and then also pruning the tree back. So I'll next talk a little bit about pruning. So we've talked about the process of growing the tree and splitting the nodes, what to do when you end up with a tree which is very large and you'd like to somehow prune it to a tree which is smaller. So the most fundamental problem with decision trees is that they overfit the data and hence do not provide good generalization. So a solution to this problem is to prune the tree, to essentially take a tree which has overfit the data and decide how you can reduce the complexity of that tree. Now, that sounds sort of logical, but note that pruning the tree will always increase the error rate on the training set. Now, why is that not a problem? Right, so you would hope that even though the error rate increases on the training set, it doesn't necessarily increase on the held out set. So one very brute force way to prune the tree would be to essentially look at its performance on a held out set and then ask the question, which of these nodes could we remove that would have the minimum impact on the error rate on the held out set? So you go through for all your leaf nodes and you evaluate the held out set on that tree minus one of those leaf nodes, and you compare those error rates and you say, well, I'll choose the tree which has the minimal impact on the held out set. And it may be that actually pruning back the one of the nodes will give you an increase in performance on the held out set. But that would be very expensive to search all the nodes and then choose one based on its performance on the held out set, because that could be computationally very expensive, since you may want to prune back a large percentage of the nodes in the tree. So we can look at things like cost complexity pruning. We can again create a metric which gives us a combination of the size of the tree and the quality of the tree. And then each node in the tree can be classified in terms of its impact on the cost complexity if it were pruned. Because now that we have this in a form, we can simply evaluate this function for n-1 nodes. And then we don't have to actually do the recognition of the held out set with each iteration. And so this is a very popular way to prune the tree. Nodes are successively pruned until certain heuristics are satisfied. So you can essentially do this in an iterative way. Remove one node, check the performance, remove the next node, check the performance, and so on. By pruning nodes that are far too specific to the training set, it's hoped that the tree will have better generalization. In practice, we use techniques such as cross-validation and held-out training data to better calibrate the generalization properties. So you can do this to decide on what... So one way, for example, you can combine these two is you can do this to decide on a subset of nodes that are candidates for pruning, and then you can actually evaluate the pruned tree, were you to prune those nodes on the held-out set. That's a way of doing fewer evaluations per pruning step. Now, there's two... when you look at the decision tree literature, there's two algorithms that you'll see referenced quite a lot. In fact, there's a number of commercial packages. When decision trees became popular in the late 90s, there were a number of companies trying to sell their versions of these decision trees, their specific implementations. And two of the most common that you would see talked about were called ID3 and C4.5. ID3 stands for the third interactive dichotomizer. It uses nominal inputs, meaning categorical data like sex, gender, that kind of age. And it allows node-specific numbers of branches. So you can actually have multi-way splits at each node, and you can have a variable number of multi-way splits at each node. So it has that kind of a flexibility built into it. And it generally, its growing strategy is to grow until all the nodes are pure. C4.5, which was a successor to ID3, is one of the most popular decision tree methods. And the features of C4.5 are that it handles real-valued variables, so it can produce a tree which says things like, make this split if X is between 3 and 4.5. It can actually learn those thresholds, 3 and 4.5, automatically from the data. So it has the ability to handle real-valued variables and create questions based on the values of those real-valued variables. It allows multi-way splits for nominal data, The splitting is based on maximization of the information gain ratio while preserving better than average information gain. So it uses a splitting measure that's sort of a combination of some of the things we talked about. Stopping is based on node purity, and then pruning is based on confidence or average node error rate. This is sometimes called pessimistic pruning, and this is, again, it's sort of a variant of some of the things we talk about. The details are, I think, beyond the scope of this course. But if you take a course in decision trees, you'll hear people talk about pessimistic pruning, or if you look on the internet. Now, you'll notice that one thing missing from the decision tree formulation that we've discussed is the whole notion of Bayesian models. We don't really take into account priors with the data here. We're simply, all of our operations are based on the actual data, what we might call a maximum likelihood approach, because we don't really factor into this any estimates of the probabilities of the data themselves. All data points are being treated as equally important. But, of course, people have extended the decision tree formulation to included notions of Bayesian techniques or Bayesian methods into decision trees and things like that. So you'll see extensions of the basic decision trees that actually are capable of taking into account Bayesian models, Bayesian priors, and things like that. Now, so what I wanted to spend a few minutes on is to wrap up today, is to talk about how we actually use these in the context of speech recognition, to make this a little more concrete, but also to show you how important decision trees are to controlling the number of parameters in a system. One of the things that are really neat about decision trees is that it allows you to reduce the complexity of a system like a hidden Markov model system and to make decisions about the parameter reductions that you make based on likelihoods of the actual data. And that's one of the reasons why decision trees have been very, very powerful in the context of speech recognition systems. So let's look at how we actually tie parameters in a speech recognition system. In a speech recognition system, we've talked about the fact that you could potentially have tens of millions of parameters if you account for every Gaussian and every state, for every phoneme and all that kind of thing. We would like a system that has much fewer parameters. So we might ask the question, what is the best way to decide what parameters we should use? So we talked about the importance in speech recognition of having context-dependent phonemes. If you talk about a particular sound when pronounced in context, changes the way it's actually pronounced. So if you talk about the sound T, for example, T will vary. Linguists will tell you there's 39 different ways you can say the sound T, depending on its neighboring context. So what we would like to do in a speech recognition system is to actually have phoneme models that take into account the left and the right context. And we do that by denoting the model as, here we have the vowel AY preceded by the consonant M and followed by the consonant S. There's 40 phonemes in English. So if you do this, you could potentially have 40 times 40 times 40 phonetic models, which is 216,000 models. It's like 64,000 models. And each one of those models is going to have three states associated with it, with many, many Gaussians per state. So we're talking about a lot of complexity. But we know from a linguistic point of view that in many cases, the left and right contexts don't really introduce that much of a change. For example, if you have a vowel preceded by a certain type of consonant and followed by a certain type of consonant, It probably doesn't matter whether that consonant was M or N and whether the following consonant was T or S. It's just the class or the type of sound that's most important. So we'd like to collapse as many of these contexts that are similar as possible. We'd also like to do this. We have these three-state models per phoneme. So we actually do this for the first states in the model. We try to collapse all the first states of all the models, all the second states of all the models, and all the third states of all the models, and we collapse those independently. So we can use the decision tree to embed linguistic knowledge into our parameter reduction process. Now, one of the reasons this works so well is that we can actually integrate this into the hidden Markov model process, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. So, on what basis should we cluster or reduce the number of acoustic models? Well, fortunately, we can draw on linguistic knowledge to do that, and we know from linguistics that we have a lot of linguistic information, the classes of sounds, and properties of these classes based on positions of the articulators and all those things. So what we do is we come up with a set of questions that relate to the linguistic properties of each one of these sounds. And those are the questions we're essentially going to ask at each node in our decision tree. And then we're able to go through a process when we grow the tree where we can actually grow the tree based on those questions. And when we're done, we can look at the clustering of these contexts and actually you can look at them and say, well, they make sense based on what we know about linguistic principles. Now, the key, that in itself is not such a big deal. Linguists could have done this manually. But what's really neat about this is that the tree-growing process is actually integrated into the Baumwelsch training process. As we go through the training process where we generate the likelihoods of the data, we actually use those likelihoods to do the tree splitting process. So you go through a pass of Baumwelsch training, and at the output of that training, you have the likelihoods of each one of the sounds associated with the data. You then can take those likelihoods and actually run the decision tree process on those likelihoods. It's embedded in the training process. And then you can generate the tree. You can then do your clustering of the parameters based on that tree, and then you can actually evaluate that tree during the training process, and then you can go back and iterate. So we actually run this decision tree-based state tying. This is a step that's done at various points in our training process as we're training our HMM models. And that gives us essentially a nice integration of the two and gives us very high-performance trees because the tree is being built at the same time that you're training the model parameters. Now, the details of that, if you're interested in this, we can show you the code, how to do this. It gets, code-wise, it's a little bit involved, but conceptually, it's pretty simple. And it's something which I have not seen done as much in other areas of technology, but this works really, really well for audio systems because it allows us to reduce the complexity of our speech recognition systems by at least an order of magnitude in terms of number of parameters, and we actually get better performance doing it. So one of the things that we'll actually iterate on when we're training a speech recognition system is the amount of state tying that we do, because that's a parameter which is very crucial to the overall performance of your system. Okay, so today we've done a little bit of an overview of how we actually train and evaluate decision trees, there are some links on the main page to some more information on this, including some of the packages that are available. There are some nice web applets that will let you play around with this as well. But if you're not using decision trees in your area of research, you might want to give it a closer look because these are very powerful for a lot of classification problems. Okay, I will see you on Wednesday.